BioInsights Podcast.
Hello, I'm David McCall, Commissioning Editor of Cell and Gene Therapy Insights. Our topic for today's podcast is one of the hottest in cell and gene therapy currently, safety. Joining us to discuss the subject are Dr. Alistair King, Dr. Francisca Neathling, Dr. Andrea Bisso, and Dr. John Mayer. Alistair is the head of biology at Eurofins Panlabs, a part of Eurofins Discovery. He has over 20 years of scientific research experience with a specific focus on drug discovery in the oncology and inflammation therapeutic areas and use of cellular assays to profile and advance drug leads. Fran is the head of biotherapeutics discovery at Eurofins Discovery. She brings over 20 years of academic, startup and pharmaceutical industry experience to support portfolio and program strategy for large molecule drug discovery. Andrea is associate director at Gadeta. There he oversees the investigation of the efficacy, safety and mechanism of action of novel cellular products by leading the preclinical pharmacology team and managing the collaborations with external partners and CROs. John is the scientific founder and chief scientific officer of Lucid Bio. He is also a clinical immunologist who leads the CAR Mechanics Research Group within King's College London. John is performing the role of moderator for our discussion today. So without further ado, over to you, John.
So welcome everybody to our podcast today about how we can maximize the safety of emerging cell and gene therapies. My name is John Marr, and I have the privilege of moderating today's discussion. Now, as we all know, drug development is a costly and a time-consuming process, and it's associated with a very significant attrition rate in the clinic. And safety is a very important factor in all of this and is a particular issue for cell and gene therapies. This point is perhaps illustrated by the fact that about 40% of all clinical holds in 2021 were attributed to this particular class of pharmaceuticals. So given that background, I think that our topic for discussion today is very timely. And since we have a great deal to cover, let me move straight to the first question for discussion. So could I start by asking, what do the panel think are the primary safety considerations at the preclinical stage? Perhaps we could kick off with Fran on this question.
Thank you, John. Yes, the primary considerations for gene therapy are vector safety, target efficiency, and feasibility. Is the target efficiently druggable with the least concomitant damage? The same can be said for cell therapy, but using different testing systems and somewhat different discovery processes and preclinical testing. The most important consideration for both approaches is whether the treatment is going to be toxic to the patient, and will there be unintended side effects, whether on or off target? Unintended cytotoxicity is also a very real concern for any drug treatment, and one that is not always predictable in vivo, in animal studies. The key is to make the drug as specific as possible to treat the condition, and there's a significant amount of in vitro investigation that can be done to ensure that.
Thank you very much for that, Fran. Perhaps we could move to Alistair next.
Following on from what Fran said, some of the aspects of biologics drug discoveries are already being dealt with in the forms of things like immunogenicity. So we're all familiar with assays that are traditionally designed to evaluate the potential immunogenicity or activation of the immune system upon administration of essentially what is a foreign agent to the body. So for cell and gene therapies, we probably should think of these kinds of therapeutic modalities with the same mindset, and especially so for cell therapies, because they are, of course, biological entities that can function and promote responses in their own right. In some cases, immune responses, especially with things like CAR Ts being of T-cell origin. So the question, I think, is do we need more complex predictive in vitro models to accommodate evaluation of these kinds of off-target activities? And genotoxicity is another thing that could potentially be a concern, perhaps thinking in terms of the gene therapy aspect of things. We have standard assays to look at genotox for things like anti-cancer agents. But again, are they enough within the context of cell and gene therapies? And so maybe this raises the question about looking at key tissues that could potentially be liabilities. Obviously, we would want to be able to target therapies to get to the tissues where they are designed to act. But do we need to put in place assays and platforms that can evaluate these off-target activities within the context of those specific tissues? And that may also be dependent upon where the target is expressed. Again, coming back to something that Fran had mentioned.
Thank you very much for that, Alistair. My own particular area is CAR T-cell immunotherapy, particularly focused on solid tumors. And I guess, you know, in that setting, the three major toxicities that we have concerns about are cytokine release syndrome, various forms of neurotoxicity, and on-target off-tumor toxicity. And I know that we're going to speak more about the need for better models later on in the discussion. But one point that I think may be helpful at the early stage of the development of a new CAR T, for example, is to consider establishing a target product profile for that particular drug, thinking particularly about where you wish to position it in the clinic, because it may raise issues such as regional delivery of cells, maybe a more appropriate route to get these cells to the site of disease. And that may also, of course, have impact on the safety of that particular drug. And the second thing I would mention in the context of preclinical modeling in animal models is that more often than not, a CAR T that you have designed will not recognize the target, the ortholog of the human target in the particular animal model that you're thinking about. And so you need to think very carefully about how to get around that problem, sometimes with the use of homologous modeling systems. Andrea, did you have any thoughts on this particular point?
I cannot do anything else than to agree with Fran, Alistair, and John what they say. I think that we are all aligned with the importance of understanding which is the safety profile of the cell-based therapies that we are developing, and in particular with the important point of the on-target of tumor or all the off-target effect. We are still looking for a consensus in between the leaders in the field, scientists from industry, biotech, but also academia, and of course the regulators. We still didn't define which is the minimum level of characterization in terms of safety that we should provide for a candidate product. We have some general guideline, but there are no established or unique assays that should be included in this characterizations. Which model should we include? We can discuss about including 2D versus 3D models. Going back to what John was mentioning, and we will discuss, I think, in a while, how to include healthy primary cells or even primary slice of tissues to really test the safety of our profile in a relevant in vitro multicellular systems. There is a boom now of additional systems that we can consider, like organoids, organs on chip, considering the great improvements in tissue in vitro engineering. All this should provide in the future new models that we can consider and we should evaluate for the capability to predict the safety of the product. And working in this direction, we should define which is a frame, indeed, the minimal set of data that are required. This is a process, will require some time, is already ongoing. And mostly we require a close collaboration and a constant feedback in between scientists, the companies, and regulators. It's worth mentioning here maybe that recently, at the beginning of the year, in March, for instance, the FDA provided two updated guidelines for industry for the development specifically of human gene therapies and cell-based therapies, in particular CAR Ts. These documents indicate somehow the way to go. They include some of the aspects that we need to address, like the antigen recognition, the characterization of the antigen recognition domain, of the target antigen, of the cellular components of our products. But on the other hand, also they leave quite a lot of flexibility, in the sense that they indeed encourage a continuous communication in between sponsors and authorities. This is basically due to the fact that at the end of the day, it's very difficult to define the details that are required and which models should be indeed used to assess the safety. And this is intrinsically due to the fact that cell-based products have their unique biology, their unique engineering and manufacturing product.
Thank you very much for that, Andrea. So to move on to a different point, we all know that predictive assays for small molecule adverse impacts, such as, for example, the Biomap toxicity signature analysis, these drew from published literature and from clinical findings. Now, one of the critical safety issues for gene therapy, e.g. the occurrence of unpredicted death of subjects treated with these advanced therapies, this means that we can't really wait for that body of literature to accrue. So how do we create more predictive approaches for these types of biologic agent? Alistair, would you like to lead on this one?
The Biomap platform, as you mentioned, is actually a very translationally relevant and predictable in vitro model platform. We've demonstrated the ability to be able to use this platform in a very highly predictive manner for things like small molecules and more traditional biologic agents, antibodies and so forth. So this shows that these kinds of in vitro models can be set up and can be set up in a way that is both clinically relevant, translational and predictive. So I think the key here is to be able to learn from some of the existing data that we have around some of the clinical evaluations for cell and gene therapies and build that into models that are more germane and relevant to those particular therapeutics. A lot of the models contained within the Biomap platform are more related to specific tissue biology and biological effects. So in some ways, really, that platform is to a degree agnostic of the therapeutic modality, because you're looking at the effect on effectively what in a clinical situation would be the surrounding tissues. And so I think really capitalizing on this kind of approach is the way to take this forward. However, I think a key aspect here would be to set up systems with what you might call, for example, in parentheses, the right biology. So modeling the kinds of biology where we are potentially seeing liabilities with cell and gene therapies, and or modeling biologies that are relevant to the particular target tissue types for those cell and gene therapies. Again, the platform and the approach itself has been proven already with other therapeutic modalities. So I think if we really pay attention to aspects that perhaps are more unique to cell and gene therapies and use that in the guidance of setting up those models and couple that with the existing and growing panel of data that we have from clinical evaluations, that will set us up very well for putting in place similar models for the cell and gene therapy field.
Fran, did you have any additional comments to make on this one?
I do. As Alistair has said, there's a lot we can do in vitro for gene therapy. We can simulate the clinical setting and assess the effect of the therapy in these in vitro models, whether by functional assays or by something like a Western blot, ELISA, or qPCR to determine the amount of expression in cells. The choice of the viral vector depends on many factors. Depending on the disease being targeted, including the amount and type of genetic material to be delivered, the location and characteristics of the cells being targeted, or aimed at limiting what we've already discussed, and that is the immune response. Viral vectors have been around for quite some time, so there's a significant amount of literature already available, with more being published very regularly. We can't wait for the new literature, but we can use the basis of this published literature to build on for safety and efficacy studies for gene therapy. Humanized mouse models or xenograft models can be used for greater accuracy in assessing the efficacy of viral vectors in humans, but they don't always translate into the human setting. With 3D cultures of different tissues or organoids becoming more common and that field growing fast, in vitro data is becoming more relevant for this field.
Thank you very much for that, Fran. Andrea, did you have any thoughts on this question?
Following up on Alistair and Fran, I would like really to stress the importance that was mentioned before of a better understanding of the physiology of an organ, of a tissue, how this behaves in normal conditions or when is present an alteration, a disease. This will be a key element to be able to then recapitulate this complexity, the complexity of an organ or of a tissue in an in vitro system that takes into account the type of cells, the microenvironment, their activities in a certain setting. And when these assays will be tested and available, I'm sure we will be able to predict in a better way which can be the safety profile of our products. Let me mention that this is a first step. So we can predict the safety of a candidate product. But on the other hand, learning from this data, we can then go back and modify the product to reduce the is maybe possible toxicity, redesign, optimize the product in a way that we can really increase its safety for patients.
Thanks for that, Andrea. And that I think is a very interesting point, something in the context of CAR-T that we found preclinically with one of our CARs, which exhibited unpredictable on-target off-tumor toxicity. And what we found was that reconfiguring the CAR so that it was co-expressed with a chemokine receptor, which preferentially trafficked the CAR-T cells into the tumor, not only boosted efficacy, but it also enhanced the safety profile of this CAR because presumably there were less of these cells in organs where they could otherwise cause toxicity. So perhaps an exemplification of the point you just made there.
Following on from some of the points that Andrea and yourself raised there, I think a key here is thinking outside the box. We have a lot of standard safety pharmacology assays that traditionally have been used for things like small molecule drug discovery. And these outline toxicities or sources of toxicities that we know and understand fairly well. I think as we get towards the more complex aspects of cell and gene therapies, and especially the cellular therapies, there is the potential for the occurrence of toxicities that we really, maybe at the current time, can't predict. And some of the examples that you both have given are good illustrations of that, where perhaps things have behaved a little differently in the way that they might have been thought to otherwise have behaved when administered. So I think we do need to be open-minded to that. And I think, as Andrea had mentioned, taking those data and using that and constantly refining the models and building back into that will really provide a key to success. And in some ways, I suppose, might provide a second generation form of safety pharmacology type approaches where one is looking at the cellular level rather than perhaps the biochemical level.
Excellent. Thank you, Alistair, for that. So moving on to a related but slightly different issue, I guess animal models, we've already commented on these, and they've met with a somewhat checkered profile of success, let's say, in predicting clinical toxicities of both cell and gene therapies. What have been your experiences here, and how do you think that non-animal alternatives, so-called NAMs, could be employed for safety testing, and how may these evolve over the next 5 or 10 years? And building on this, considering the recent FDA Modernization Act, what do you think will be the greatest challenges to implement non-animal alternatives in preclinical testing? That was a bit of a mouthful. Andrea, would you like to speak to this one first?
So I think that it's pretty clear that we are facing with a growing scientific knowledge and a terrific technological development, and that we have and we will have more and more sophisticated in vitro non-animal models that will be helpful in predicting the safety and efficacy, of course, also of our cell and gene therapies. So the real question is, what will be the space of animal models, if any, in the future, are still viable? Let me discuss a little bit from my personal perspective, that is of from the perspective of a cell-based therapy for tumors. As you all know, here we are also, of course, experiencing increased use or more advanced and complex in vitro models and assays to assess safety and efficacy. I'm thinking to the use of, for instance, 3D culture organoids and spheroids, possibly in combination with other cell or soluble factors that somehow recapitulate the specific microenvironment of a specific tumor. That allow the investigation in vitro of the efficacy of cell-based therapy. We have a lot of space for those. We use a lot now also primary healthy tissues or healthy organoids with the idea to assess the safety and toxicity of the products, or even more complex hybrid pharmacology toxicology models in which maybe we can mix normal healthy cells, we can culture these cells possibly in 3D with target transformed cells. And then the effect of a product can be simultaneously measured both on both components, better recapitulated what the real situation of a patient is. I will say that all these assays in vitro are in place and will gain more and more space in the next 5 to 10 years. But despite all these improvements, we somehow, I think we are still bound to the use of the animal models for specific questions. I think that one of the reasons is that somehow we are limited on the type of answers that that we can have from in vitro models. For instance, if we think to the possibility to investigate the homing and trafficking of a cellular product into an organ or into a tissue. We are all aware that there are even huge limitations somehow in the animal models. We may have not time to dissect all these limitations here, just to mention maybe allogeneic and xenogenic reactions, the lack of human cytokines that may support cell survival, homing and expansion, the lack of cross-reactivity that was mentioned before for mouse targets, and so on. But these mouse models have still a value indeed. The trafficking of a cellular product can be at the moment carefully assessed only on these models. Just think about difficulty to recapitulate in vitro the abnormal vascularization that you can observe in a tumor, and how much this can affect the efficacy of a therapy.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that, Andrea. Alistair, did you have any further thoughts on this point?
Absolutely, John. I think Andrea's raised some excellent points there in terms of the challenges that we face with existing animal models, how potentially we might need to develop those ideas further, and especially as we aim to try and get away from animal models with reducing, refining, and improving the models that we do have. As we discussed a little bit earlier, things like the Eurofins Biomap platform is an excellent way of illustrating how we can do this in vitro in a very highly translational, relevant, and predictable manner. And as Andrea mentioned, sometimes there are events that occur within a disease context or that are not immediately obvious prior to using that therapeutic within the context of an in vivo model. So then building that back into those in vitro models that we have to more accurately model the biology. And the way I see this is it is a constant process of refinement. So whereas we often talk in terms of some of the initiatives to reduce and refine animal models, we should also do the same thing for the in vitro models and use those pieces of data that we generate from the in vivo models to help boost the predictability and the power of the in vitro models. And I think we're actually at a very exciting point in the development of these kinds of models to support drug discovery from the perspective of having a vast number of omics capabilities available, proteomic modeling, looking at metabolomics, transcriptomics. We have a wealth of data there that can potentially be generated. And I think coupled with the fact now that we are much more able at the current time to evaluate larger sets of data, this puts us in a somewhat unique position of being able to then look at the complexity of these biological systems in response to cell and gene therapies and to generate not so much yes-no responses with respect to certain targets, but perhaps more safety toxicity type fingerprints and to look at those. Because I think it's fair to say that for any therapeutic, even perhaps for the same target, there may be different safety profiles that are generated. So again, coming back to that idea of a safety or a toxicology fingerprint, I think is the way to go. And if one thinks a little bit further beyond that, we have things like machine learning and artificial intelligence that I'm pretty sure we can then bring to bear in evaluating those large data sets that we can generate from these in vitro models, and then maybe even move towards more in silico predictability with respect to the kinds of safety and toxicity issues that one might expect. Of course, we would still need to evaluate whether those safety and toxicity effects do occur, but I think it's moving in the right direction there and capitalizing on some of the technologies that we have at our fingertips right now.
Fran, did you have any additional comments to make on this one?
Yes, just a small one, and that is that there's relatively little guidance from authorities for cell and gene therapy, considering that some of it has been around for quite some time. We can help build the body of data that could allow clients to have conversations with the authorities that can help to shape guidance in the future. Eurofins and other CROs have done that in the past for other therapeutic moieties and safety studies, so there's no reason why we cannot do that for cell and gene therapy. We already have various capabilities as touched on by Alistair. We have these up and running routinely, and we can deliver the type of data that clients will need to present to the authorities at an IND conversation, for instance, with reduced need for animal testing.
So, certainly from my own experience in the CAR T space operating in the UK, the strong feedback I've had from the regulators is that they want to see data surrounding the safety and the efficacy of the therapeutic drug product, which in this case, of course, is a human CAR T cell. And really, the only way that can be done in vivo under existing guidelines is using animal models. So I'm really heartened by the recent moves by the FDA and others to start to broaden this out so that these are no longer a compulsory component of preclinical testing. And it's been referred to already in the discussion so far, but we have a wealth of in vitro models to choose from organotypic cultures, iPSC-derived differentiated cell types, and organ-on-a-chip cultures. structures, which I think look extremely elegant. For example, you can have a pulmonary organ on a chip in which you have lung epithelial cells in an air channel. So they're in their natural environment and they're separated from endothelial cells in a blood channel using a semi-porous membrane. So you have all the components in that system to infuse CAR T cells in through the blood channel and examine, can they be incited to traffic into the epithelial layer and what kind of damage can they do? So I can see great potential for some of these in vitro model systems in satisfying some of these questions in the not too distant future. Perhaps changing tack to another important question, and that surrounds the whole area of innovation. I think we're all agreed that the need for innovation is absolutely enormous in this space. And how do you, the panel, envisage that existing platforms could be modified, thinking not only about the technologies themselves, but also target-related issues?
I think some of the learnings that we have from clinical failures, we need to explore a little bit more how that is occurring. In previous clinical evaluations, the way I see it is that failure comes from three sources. There may be a lack of efficacy, which often is related to the target or the validation of that target. There is the occurrence of off-target toxicity that may not necessarily have been seen and or predicted from existing assays that are put in place. Then there is also the target-related toxicity. So that they're three very different areas. Now, I think really in being able to address the middle topic there, the off-target toxicities that may not necessarily have been seen and or predicted, this is where we need more complex predictive platforms to help address whether there would be expected off-target activities. The simple fact of there being off-target means that there is going to be some degree of not necessarily knowing what is going to happen. And so I think this is where having models in place, coming back to some of the conversations we've had around animal models or mimicking those, and the complexity of the biology that is involved within the context of a living body, I think becomes all the more important there, because that is agnostic by nature, and it is also more thorough in terms of its generation of data or ability to provide data that can itself be more predictive in terms of seeing how these toxicities may manifest themselves. But I think with the existence now of more complex platforms, and we talked a little bit about some of the omics platforms, not least of which are things like transcriptomics, but now getting into things like metabolomics and the consequences that changes in those systems can elicit, and understanding how those changes occur, building that back into those models, I think that really is a way to be able to address those off-target toxicities and those that traditionally aren't seen with some of the existing models that we have. I think that will go a long way to being able to address those issues earlier in drug discovery to mitigate those risks when declaring a candidate and going forward into clinical trials. And I think the technology advances there will undoubtedly enhance our abilities in this whole off-target tox area. And from that perspective, then, it still leaves target-related toxicity. And this will more than likely need to come from other avenues. And that may be, for example, partnerships with academic research, for example, looking at how modulation of a given target can manifest not only in disease tissues or in target tissues, but in other tissues, and tissues that perhaps from the perspective of drug discovery for treating a disease in a particular tissue, those other tissues may not necessarily be an immediate focus. But for something like academic research, where one is potentially looking in a whole range of different tissues and systems, that I think can provide tremendous value in terms of helping validate the target, not so much specifically from an efficacy perspective, obviously that is important, but also validating the target from the perspective of safety.
Great, thanks very much for that, Alistair. Fran, what were your thoughts on this particular question?
Some of that innovation can also lead, as I mentioned before, to building guidance for the industry and helping regulators perhaps to set the right guidance. While we're addressing safety, we can work with clients to optimize their methods to build a more efficient process. Several of the gene therapy programs have problems with producing enough of the viral material to be able to characterize it appropriately. And there's definitely room for improvement. And we can help them with that. We can help them optimize their methods. We can help them expand their processes. And all of this is done by us monitoring new innovation and considering implementation so that when a client comes to us with a request, we can do the innovation for them. They don't have to build out their infrastructure or add new technology to their in-house processes.
Andrea, did you have any further thoughts you'd like to add?
Yes, I would like to follow up a little bit on Alistair. Basically, we know that we have a great technological development, and the application of these omics, all the omic techniques from transcriptomics into metabolomics, etc., allow us to gain an unprecedented molecular characterization understanding of the behavior of a particular cell, or in this case, potentially of our cell products. And of course may help, as Alistair was saying, in better understanding the on-target and off-target unwanted effects. I really think that a combination of the omics with single cell technology, spatial technologies, will allow us to make a further step. And we will be able, hopefully, to really investigate, for instance, the potential heterogeneity that is within our cellular products, and better understanding whether this is at the basis of a potential issue in terms of safety or lack of efficacy. All this will lead to the possibility to maximize the safety and the efficacy of a product. I'm thinking, for example, to identification of a specific subpopulation a product cell that can cause some unwanted toxicity. Its identification can allow us to adopt strategies to reduce the impact of this population within the product, for instance, by tweaking the conditions of manufacturing to exclude this population. Or on the contrary, if we have a population that is particularly effective within our product that has specific features, we can manufacture in a way to try to expand and have these components more representative and effective.
Thank you very much for those comments, Andrea. I think you really highlight one of the issues we have in many forms of cell therapy, which is the lack of standardization of these products. But when it comes to, the question, I suppose, is about innovation. And when it comes to CAR-T, frankly speaking, I struggle sometimes to keep up with all of the innovation that's going on because there is so much activity in this space. And just to give a flavor, a tip of the iceberg type view of that innovation, we're seeing the advent of many forms of controllable CARs. For example, CARs whose expression is dependent upon the presence of a second pharmaceutical, or alternatively CARs which are only expressed under conditions of hypoxia, so that they are only switched on in the hypoxic, or preferentially switched on in the hypoxic tumor microenvironment. There's a tremendous amount of innovation around the development of so-called gated CARs, which are not just recognizing a single target, but instead are recognizing a signature which is associated with the tumor microenvironment. It may be a dual sensing CAR system. It may be a syn-notch system. There are many variations. We're also seeing the advent of CARs, which are being used as drug delivery devices in their own right. They can be armored either to produce cytokines, which have the capacity to modulate the tumor microenvironment, or indeed to produce oncolytic viruses, just to give you two examples. Another area of enormous innovation at the moment is refinement of the signaling properties of CARs. For example, calibrating the activation signal by mutating ITAM units in the activation module, potentiating co-stimulation by placement of co-stimulatory units in their natural location close to the plasma membrane. And as I say, this is just really the tip of the iceberg in terms of tweaking the CAR itself. Of course, CARs need a cell within which to work, and modification of the cell host using some of the approaches, in fact, that Andrea just commented upon, for example, selecting different subsets of T cells, which may be the most long-lived in vivo and therefore give you the greatest therapeutic impact, or indeed manufacturing these cells in the presence of chemicals which can retard the differentiation of the cells, thereby ensuring that they have a greater capacity to proliferate and to persist in the patient. We're seeing the advent, of course, of a huge toolbox of genome editing technologies, which also further the potential for innovation in this space. Just as one example, the advent of base editing, which allows us to modify gene expression without the introduction of double-stranded DNA breaks, thereby potentially reducing the genotoxicity of this kind of approach. And a final area of innovation that I'm very aware of is around manufacturing. And if you're in the cell therapy business, manufacturing is core business for you. So the advent of automated platforms to reduce the human factor in manufacturing, and also shortening the speed of the manufacturing process. And this is not just about reducing cost of goods, but it's also about achieving a fitter, less differentiated cell product. So we're now seeing some manufacturing processes which are as short as 24 hours or less, or even in vivo delivery of vectors to transduce T cells in the patient rather than manufacturing ex vivo. So I think I should stop on that note, because I think innovation in this space is something that one could speak about for hours on end, and we don't have that time available to us. So I'll change tack and move on to a different question now. We've talked about CROs already in the discussions, and I guess I'd be interested to hear how the panel members go about choosing an outsourcing partner. What is the primary role of the CRO, in other words? Andrea, would you like to speak to this one first?
I can speak from the perspective of a small biotech, like Data, but I think that what I'm going to say may hold true for also for bigger organizations. So the main reasoning to go for an outsourcing partner for us is to get access to complex assays and services that we cannot or will not make sense for us to set up in-house for the lack of resources, know-how, and capability or access to material. In other words, what we look is a balance in between having access to high-quality, complex translational assays, possibly coupled with proper advanced bioinformatic analysis, when these, of course, are needed, and a reasonable and affordable cost for the company. On the other hand, we also value a lot the possibility to customize these assays based indeed on the goal of a specific study or the experimental needs, and mostly on the features of specific and unique candidate cell-based product. For example, I'm thinking assays like the BioMap or high-throughput assays based on the use of advanced imaging and perhaps based on the use of primary material from patients that require a lot of setup, know-how, and access to precious patient material. So for a biotech, for a small biotech, having the possibility to perform these assays in collaboration with the CRO will allow us to test what we need, a higher number of variables and multiple replicates. I'm thinking to, for instance, number of patients or donors, and lead acquisition of really valuable data that will allow a risk reduction for the company. Last consideration that I would like to make is the importance also of the timing of the experiments. Of course, we are all aware that we need to get the results as soon as possible and as early as possible in the development of a product. And so this is another parameter that is very important when we select a CRO. I mean, the possibility of a fast and agile communication, the fast execution then of the experiment, of the collaboration, are really relevant parameters that we take into account when we decide in favor of a partner.
So having heard Andrea's opinion from the customer side of the table, I can tell you that we as a CRO work in a very consultative way with a client throughout the execution of a project. We need a clear understanding of what the needs are, and then together with a client, we decide what the approach is going to be. We can either customize what we already have in our very versatile catalog of capabilities, or we can develop new approaches and assays if required. We communicate regularly. We keep the client up to date on progress. Reduction of risk in execution of the project is a key consideration, with, of course, the focus on reduction of risk in the clinical setting. As Andrea just said, quality, cost, and speed are of the utmost importance to our clients, and we're very aware of that as we go about our business. While we don't focus on the cost of a project, we do try and do everything as efficiently as possible, both in terms of cost and time, so that we can deliver the right data to our clients so they can move their projects forward in an efficient manner.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Fran. Alistair, did you have any thoughts on this particular point?
Yes, John. Thinking about the role of the CRO from perhaps a more global overarching perspective, obviously one of the fundamentals is to listen to our clients' needs. And Fran's touched on that in terms of some of the tactical aspects for conducting the study. I think from a perhaps a more strategic perspective, we're in the position of seeing and certainly looking at things from the safety and the toxicology aspects, seeing trends in the industry. So understanding where the same kinds of toxicities or safety issues are coming up time and again, that becomes the need in the field. And so not only listening to our individual clients on a project-by-project basis, but listening to the industry and seeing where those needs are changing. And I think as we develop newer therapeutic modalities, cell and gene therapy being perfect examples of that, we are uncovering new needs in the field in a whole variety of different aspects of drug discovery. So I think those are parts of the key and the roles of a CRO. The other aspect to it, of course, is listening to the regulatory authorities as we gain more understanding as to how cell and gene therapies work, where some of the key issues are that need to be resolved with those, just as there would be with any other therapeutic. The regulatory agencies will eventually formulate their own framework for what they would like to see as part of the vetting of an agent before declaring a candidate or approving it for going on into clinical trials. So I think, again, from a CRO's perspective, not only listening to the client, but listening to the industry and listening to the regulatory requirements are some of the key aspects to our being able to provide services that are relevant and appropriate for the needs of the industry. And I think really we've talked about it in some of the other topics that we've discussed in this podcast, but one of the powers of the CROs really comes from having not only a wide range of technologies, but platforms available. And we're in the perhaps somewhat privileged position of seeing things from the 10,000 foot view. We can see a broader picture of some of the safety issues, some of the toxicity issues that are perhaps becoming more recurrent. And obviously, every study that we conduct with each one of our clients is under the strictest of confidentiality. But there are nonetheless trends that one sees from the perspective of safety and toxicity that are of a non-proprietary nature. And we've seen this before with some of the safety pharmacology consortia that have been set up that have provided tremendous value in outlining practices and some of the assays that are needed there, in particular for things like small molecule drug discovery. So I think really being in that position of being able to bring to bear not only some of the technologies that we've discussed, but sophisticated bioinformatics and analytical approaches can then provide additional value and impact to the kinds of services that we provide in addressing the potential liabilities of a particular agent with respect to safety pharmacology and toxicities.
Great. Thank you all for those comments. I must say I find it very heartening to hear from the CRO perspective how important, or how much emphasis rather, you place on listening to the client. I think that's really important. I think the cultural fit is one of the key things in my experience in dealing with CROs, as well as, of course, ensuring that they have the relevant competencies and can deliver at speed as well. Moving on to the next topic, what is the view of the panel on virtual companies and whether they can succeed in this space as well as they might for small molecules, for example? And, you know, do virtual companies have special needs regarding assays and safety considerations? Fran, would you like to lead on this one?
Some small biotechs might have assays or materials they want to transfer to us, while a virtual company might have the intellectual input based on previous experience that their team has had. They may have a larger need for assays to be built or established, and we can certainly do that for them. We can customize assays that we already have up and running, as we've said before, to meet client needs. And the bottom line is that we're all in this together and we can work together to accommodate the needs of both virtual companies and other partners that might need our services. We are their lab, so they don't need to establish or expand one.
I think Fran touched on a very good point there, and that is that we're not working in pursuit of new therapeutics in isolation. So I think a key aspect of maybe a way to view the CRO dynamic, and this really pertains to companies like virtual companies, is that we're effectively part of their drug discovery team. And the question of what differences there might be between the needs of virtual companies versus other, perhaps more traditional drug discovery companies, where there are internal assets and lab space and things like that, is a very interesting one. But when one considers the needs of drug discovery per se, they're generally very similar and really only differ in terms of the therapeutic modality being developed. Obviously, cell and gene therapies have different things that need to be explored as compared with, say, more traditional biologics or small molecules. And so, as a result, the same needs exist within that program, regardless of where it is situated. So again, it comes back to the idea that although the challenges are the same, the real difference between a virtual company and other companies is what is in existence within their own labs or not, as the case may be. So it comes back to that notion of us essentially being a part of, or at least from the bench level perspective in those cases, for virtual companies, their drug discovery team. And so I think if one begins to dispense with those sort of notions of the CROs being in a different space from either the pharma companies, the biotechs, or the virtual companies. But as Fran pointed out very aptly, we're all in it together. And so being able to contribute both intellectually from an advisory perspective, or leveraging the experience that we have. Obviously, people within the CRO world are experts within the context of the assays and services that they provide. And many have pharma industry experience themselves, myself included. And so I think that really does help to get rid of some of those barriers and some of those areas where there might be less opportunity for cross-pollination between the companies. So coming back again to thinking about the CROs as being part of a drug discovery team rather than a CRO in isolation, I think that's really a key to being able to function very well with really any kind of client, and especially from the perspective of the virtual companies where we have the infrastructure and the hardware to be able to conduct the experiments that are needed as part of those drug discovery programs.
Finally, I guess, time to wrap up, I suppose. How can we all work together to safely advance cell and gene therapies? What are your closing thoughts on this particular question after the very interesting discussion that we've just had?
This has been a very interesting discussion. And I hope that we all came to the same conclusion that CROs work with clients not only to assess and ensure safety for cell and gene therapies, but that we can work with them to optimize their processes with the goal of a faster and safer path to the clinic. The take-home message for the audience today is that the CRO industry is there to work with any client who needs us to execute their complex assays that they don't routinely run in-house, freeing up their scientists to do other aspects of research and development that they can easily do, or allow them access to technology that they may not have available. We can work collaboratively with them to get their therapeutics to patients as fast and as safely as possible.
Andrea, what are your closing thoughts on this this question?
I'm pretty much aligned with Fran. I think that indeed working together, academia, CROs, industry, with the final goal to create novel and better products and characterize better the features, the safety profile, will be the key for success. Let me just stress one point that I really care about, that is the focus that we should put. We should never forget that we start from biology or from pathology, and a better understanding of this context the context in which a cell should work will allow us really to develop better models and better knowledge around the product itself toward a better efficacy in vivo and a more safety profile.
Thank you very much, Andrea. Alistair, what are your closing thoughts?
I think Andrea touched on it perfectly. It all starts with the biology, and there are processes, there are things that need to be followed as part of drug discovery that can be different from one therapeutic modality to another. But when we think about it, and we've talked about some of the aspects of it from the technological standpoint, from the organizational standpoint, and so forth, that everybody has something to bring to the table with respect to drug discovery, whether they're present in a pharma company, an academic organization, a CRO, a biotech. Everybody has their different areas of expertise, and that's the fundamental nature of any drug discovery team, whether it's located within one organization or matrixed across multiple organizations. And I think we heard the term a little bit earlier, we're all in it together, and nothing is truer than that. We are very much all in it together at all levels of drug discovery, and seeing that successes, and ultimately, as I think Fran mentioned, getting therapeutics to patients who are in need of these. that certainly is my goal, and I know it's the goal of everybody else working in the drug discovery field. And that's a common bind that brings us all together. So we truly are all in it together, and I'm looking forward to seeing how in this very interesting therapeutic field we can develop newer, more efficacious and safer medicines.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Alistair, for those thoughts. I really don't have very much to add at all, except to re-emphasize what's just been said about the need for a more collaborative approach going forward. I think that's going to be the key to success in all of this.
Well, thanks very much indeed to John, our moderator, and to Fran, Alistair and Andrea, our panel, for a fascinating discussion. This episode was brought to you in partnership with Eurofins Discovery. If you enjoyed listening, don't forget to subscribe to the BioInsights podcast.